meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, and it's my favorite part of the week when I can get together with a few of my med student pals, people like Aline Sanduk, Greg Woods, Casey McCleary. But what makes today super special is that we've got a new podcaster rocking the mic today, a new victim, a shiny new example of the pinnacle of the modern medical school student. Say hello, a special hello. Don't just say hello, say a special hello, podcast audience, to Caroline A.D. Sanderson. I think you can feel their welcoming attitude, can't you?
I can. It feels so warm.
You're basking in the glow. What's A.D. stand for?
So, A is my middle name, Adele, and then Dickie is my maiden name.
Ah.
Had to keep it in there. Couldn't let it go.
Sorry, listeners, she's married. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Happy to have you. So, I was perusing studentdoctor.net last night desperately for ideas about what to talk about, as I sometimes do. And I ran across a post by The Nightingale, in which he or she laments her lack of clinical skills. She says that her school is known for great residents, I guess for producing great residents, according to her school. So we'll just put that out there. But as an M2, she's already concerned that she sucks at clinical.
Oh, did you get the impression it was a girl?
Well, The Nightingale, I guess that just struck me as a girl name.
I didn't think you would like that, Dave.
You know what?
Stereotypes.
You know what?
I am officially a jerk. A boy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, especially when the first comment afterwards said, you know, we're all in it with you, bro. Not that means anything, but after that comment, for some reason, I just defaulted to, okay, it must be a bro. All right, I'll just keep reading. But
can be gender neutral.
But The Nightingale, yeah, that makes me wonder. I don't know.
Hey.
Well, Florence was a woman.
My apologies to The Nightingale for assuming that you are a girl, a lady, a woman. Now, in his or her school, as in ours, they start seeing patients in the first year. And in the second year, they apparently do primary care clerkship, and the school claims their students get constant clinical exposure, but he or she has never been able to master her clinical skills because she's too busy learning basic science. And she wanted to know, basically the gist of her question was, is she abnormally incompetent or normally incompetent? I think everybody was like, no, it's cool. But why? I mean, what is it with you people?
Us people?
And our self-confidence problem?
Yeah, yeah.
We've been trained to never think that we're good enough so that we'll keep working harder and fighting each other all the way until here.
Fighting each other.
Actually, University of Iowa has done a really good job, I think, of setting up a program where we don't want to fight each other, but a lot of schools still have extremely, like, infighty competitive programs with, like, gunners and...
People still do that, though.
People still
like,
do
there's,
that.
There's a fair amount of... Really? Psychological warfare that gets lobbed around. Oh, yeah, for
really?
Sure.
People.
Well, I think over time...
Make a note of that, young man.
Just gravitate towards each other and kind of drop off into their own corner because they're the only people who can stand to be around that. So over time, it gets better, but...
Oh, okay.
One thing that I think sets the University of Iowa apart is our approach to training for the physical exam. Because we use all these standardized patients, and University of Iowa was kind of a trailblazer in that respect going back many years, we have this outlet to essentially to be bad at the physical exam before we really get into real patients. And while we do work with real patients very early on, they don't always have us just dive right in and do the entire history and the entire physical exam. Second year, yes. But that is still in a more controlled environment. It's not like they just turn you loose and let you go off and do your own thing. So by having these standardized patients, I think this really helps us to be able to learn and be bad when we start off. Because as everybody pointed out in this thread, everybody is bad when they start off because we're all learning it for the first time.
One of the things I started thinking about was if the unintended consequence of the LCME's recommendation to integrate basic and clinical sciences was whether it might create sort of a delay in competence. I mean, you know, sort of of that feeling of competence. You know, like while you're trying to do all of this stuff at once, does it just mean that it takes longer to feel like you're doing a good job?
I think that definitely could happen. Like last semester, you know, we're studying for our
you're a one.
Exams and stuff. Yeah,
your
yeah.
first year.
I'm an M1. So, and this is the first year of our new curriculum. So it's especially kind of uncertain at times. But personally, I don't know about everyone else, but I definitely kind of crammed for the physical exam skills kind of the day before. And
it's a super memorization intensive
yes.
task, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean,
it is.
So
it's just kind of do this,
especially when you do it the first time. I mean, you kind of want to.
Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like I've learned really like what if I find something that's abnormal, I wouldn't really be able to tell you what that means or what the next step is yet. I think like it's important to know that they're just getting us exposed to the exam skills themselves, and then other things will come later. So I think early exposure, where like even though maybe we aren't mastering them as well yet, I think the earlier exposures will help us later on.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think it's a matter of like lowering your expectations a little bit, and rather than thinking like, okay, I had this one day of clinical skills practice where I like crammed in everything and now I'm just supposed to have it perfect, to just accept that that is just a getting your feet wet moment, and it's just an exposure moment, and not expect yourself to be a professional basically.
Or even many exposures. I mean, I expect,
oh, yeah.
You know, like I expect that something like this would take a heck of a long time to develop well. And you know, to become second nature, that takes a lot of work. And so in the meantime, you sort of, I would expect that you sort of fake it till you make it. I mean,
yeah. And I don't think they expect us to know it either. Like maybe because we've just did sort of a touch and go, one pass kind of thing, people might feel like, oh, we're already, you know, administration expects us to know this now because we studied it and now we're done. But I mean, I think it's gonna keep coming back and coming back, and I don't think anybody actually expects us to be old pros at it for having done it once, and we shouldn't expect that from ourselves either.
A couple of pieces of advice to Nightingale. What I would say is that no matter who you're working with, they have probably seen worse than what you're doing right now. Even if you are.
What if they haven't?
That's what you view as. Well, we don't talk about that.
Okay, not tell you.
I didn't mean to bring that up.
So first off, you know, take solace in probably out there, there's been a lot worse. Second, it's such a multifaceted skill to learn, because not only do you have to go through the motions and you have to learn what to do in what order, more or less, you can be a little bit fluid with it, you also have to learn to do it on the fly. You have to learn to adapt. You have to learn to do it on patients that maybe can't cooperate very well. Maybe they're bedridden. Maybe they can't get up and lean forward so that you can percuss their back and listen to their lungs and everything. It's all a process. And just like anything that has that many steps, whether it's a dance or whether it's working on a car and trying to figure out what needs to be done there too, it's just a process, and you have to kind of check things off, and over time, you get more used to it.
Not only that, but I mean, so yeah, once you can go through the motions, then there's the idea of actually getting information from it, which,
right.
You know, for instance, like I've heard that heart murmurs, extremely difficult to mm-hmm. for, you know, people to detect. And sometimes mm-hmm. I think we, I don't know, might be like, oh, yeah, I heard that.
Another good thing. yeah, we've been there. But another good thing that the university
Never.
Does, especially in the second year, is they bring in patients who have specific things like that. They have a heart murmur. They have a brewery somewhere. They have some sort of condition, an enlarged liver or anything like that, so that you can actually feel that. And you can actually listen to those things. And you can actually get experience firsthand at what those are like should you find them in a real patient. Obviously, doing the standardized patients, that's one of the pitfalls. Most of them don't have things that are wrong with them. So you go through the motions literally because you know, well, I'm probably not going to find anything, but I'll listen and I'll be sure just in case.
I actually had a standardized patient who, I was like, okay, everything looks good, you know, because that's what you say. Mm-hmm. And she was like, are you sure? Take another look. And she has scoliosis and, you know, abnormal curvature of her spine. And so it took me a while.
How bad?
I mean,
was it like, you know,
She had, like, she also had kyphosis, so she had, like, a kind of a hump.
Okay.
And then, but I guess the scoliosis, I wouldn't be able to tell you how bad. I could notice if I was looking at it. So I wouldn't say it was, like, a heart murmur where it's like, yeah, sure. But if you're looking for it, you could notice.
Right.
Yeah. I had a standardized
patient. You were engaging in imposter syndrome, which,
yes,
you know, faking it till you're making it, which is,
you know,
common,
just,
I think,
an everyday thing for me.
It's common. It predates basic/clinical integration in curricula. So, you know, that's cool.
I had a standardized patient when I was practicing for the like clinical exam final, and I spent like 10 or 15 minutes of our practice, half an hour, trying to find her pulse, and I don't know why I could not find this lady's pulse. And she was like, no, it's right here. And I was like, I can't find it. She was like, are you saying I don't have a pulse? Are you saying I'm dead? Are you saying I'm dead?
I'm dead.
I was like, no.
You're breathing, so I know you've got one.
Yeah. You have some skin, some color in your skin. Like, I think you're okay.
That's very diagnostic. Good job.
Having some problems down here.
Did you guys ever see that movie, Death Becomes Her? Mm-mm. With Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn.
Oh, yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, that's a really old movie. I just
the image
myself
that popped into my head was of Meryl Streep with her head on backwards.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah
right?
That's yeah right. That's right. That movie. Anyway, they're both like fighting over this like scientist who invents like the youth formula. And one of them is his wife and the other one is his mistress. But anyway, in the end, he like, you know, doesn't even want the formula and just like runs away and has a really great life. Anyway, the point is, they like both go to a doctor and the doctor puts a stethoscope up to her chest and like can't hear anything. So the image that I have in my mind is that he just goes to the trash and like throws the stethoscope down the trash.
Goes and gets a new one. I've heard that there's a sort of normal.
Yeah.
But it was my thumb that couldn't feel it. I can't throw my thumb in the trash.
Yeah. Are you supposed to look with your thumb? I thought that was
I was doing pulse. Yeah. Well, it depends on the
don't you have a pulse in your thumb?
Normally. Or fingers. I guess fingers.
Yeah, fingers tend to.
No, I was feeling her
wrist. That's what I remember from. Yeah.
Maybe that was my problem.
That's what I remember from CPR. That's, you know.
Yeah.
I've also heard that this is sort of normal competency curve for.
Sure.
For medical students, where, you know, so you start off as an M1 and you know nothing, and then it sort of gradually goes up until you begin your clinical years, and then it shoots back down, and then it gradually goes up until you're an M4, and then it shoots back down as you're an intern, and sort of there's that roller coaster that you have.
Or at least you feel that way. Yeah.
It's all relative.
You know nothing. Yes. M1.
I think that's true though.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the process. Hmm? One poster made a really good point about how, like, you're supposed to constantly feel like you don't know anything, because otherwise you get really comfortable and complacent, and then you stop trying because you think you know everything.
If you get to this point where you're an M4 and you're like, well, I know everything, you know, you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
I think that's also partially the nature of med school, because they're throwing so many things at you. You're not going to learn every single subject and every single activity at the same rate. So there's always going to be one that's ahead of the other, so you're always going to be feeling like there's a deficit in something, even though you may know other stuff. And then eventually that'll reverse. You'll know more about the thing that you put more time into, and then you'll feel deficit in something else. So it's always going to be that kind of back and forth ping pong effect. And that's normal. People will always go into a physical exam and forget to even take a pulse sometimes, because they'll try to figure out, all right, I need to do the musculoskeletal, I need to do the lungs, I need to do all this stuff. Oh, shoot, I never took your blood pressure. And that's something so simple, but until you do it a bunch of times, those things happen.
Do they still pair you with somebody else and you do physical exams on each other?
Yes.
How awkward is that?
So actually, talking about pulses and things, when my partner first listened to my heartbeat, it was when one of our faculty members came in. He was a pretty intimidating guy. And as he's listening to my chest, he goes,
who was it? Come on, name me.
No, I'm all fine.
All right.
He, as he's listening, and the you know, professor's looking over his shoulder, he goes, I think I hear a third heartbeat. I kind of perk up, and I'm like, what? And he listens in, the professor, and he says, well, he's definitely tachycardic right now that you said that, but I'm pretty sure that I'm pretty sure his heartbeats are normal. Okay, there, he's normalized again. You're fine. So, yeah, it is kind of awkward.
So good luck to the Nightingale. Relax. It's okay.
I want to talk about student doc network a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
Ooh. Oh my god, yes.
Have you guys ever posted on there? I mean, who does that? Who actually posts? on Student Doc Network.
I can't get on. I just can't bring myself to even get on there and look at stuff because I'll get so paranoid and so just like caught up in it that I pretty much just avoid it flat out whenever possible.
Yeah, it was the worst. Like when you're applying, and so you go to like the University of Iowa thread, or you go to the whatever. Every school has a thread, and people post on there like, got an interview on this day, and you know,
like,
you're
shut
like
up.
I haven't gotten an interview yet.
Shut your face, we don't care. Good
yeah
for you.
It's not even helpful. But so I don't know, I made myself stop going there, but I don't know, I've never met someone who actually uses it or posts on
I don't think they'd have the audacity to admit who they are, because the only post better than the one Caroline was just talking about is when people are like, oh, I have a 45 MCAT and a 4.0 and I built a clinic in Southeast Asia that saves all these, am I gonna get in guys, like,
do I even have a chance? Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I would punch you if I could.
Yeah,
seriously.
Anyway, I just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, it's a total circle.
That would be something that if we did deal with a tech issue at some point, maybe people would like to send stuff in and let us know. Do you actually pay attention to that sort of thing? How much does that weigh on you as you're either waiting for your application to come in, or you're thinking about applying, or you have questions about the program? Is a place like that somewhere you would go to look?
It was helpful for, like, sometimes they post, like, I got my secondary application, and here were the questions on it. Or, you know, I had my interview, and this is what they asked me.
Are you allowed to do that?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't
it happened.
Stopping them.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It's anonymous.
Yeah.
Well, okay. That sounds good. We'll be back in just a minute on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back. I just wanted to mention a couple upcoming episodes of the Short Code Podcast that we've got in the works. In the coming week, New York Times bestselling author Sam Keen will be visiting us, and we'll be doing an interview with him. He's the author of the book The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain, as revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery, which I've just started reading, and it's super cool. In early February, med students Melissa Palma and Hana Kadir will be talking with us about their experiences with what I'm thinking of as border medicine, issues that relate to immigration. And in April, during a session of the Examined Life Conference, Lisa Ware, Eric Wilson, Matt Maves, and Ethan Craig, and I will be podcasting to conference attendees, sort of live. Not exactly sure what we'll be talking about yet. but we have some ideas, maybe interviews of some interesting guests who will be there. So stay tuned for all of that.
Well, those of you who know that I am the epitome of hip, I'm sure.
Yes, I have noticed that.
And one thing that I have been watching over time is the evolution
It's your large horn-rimmed glasses and your giant beard.
I try.
And your plaid shirts and... Yes.
I didn't think anybody noticed, so I appreciate that.
I did.
Thank you.
That's a joke only we can appreciate, listeners. Sorry.
Gonna have to put up pictures of people again.
So part of the evolving technology is putting everything into watches or into glasses and Google-related things. So this started a few years ago with the Gluco Watch, if you heard of that, that looks at a diabetic's glucose level through their watch. Well, that wasn't a perfect solution, and over time that has evolved into something that just came out from the University of California, San Diego a couple of days ago. I think this is fascinating. They're combining glucose measurements with temporary tattoos. So instead of pricking your finger 8 to 10 times a day, you can put on a temporary tattoo and get your glucose readings.
Wow. Oh, cool. I saw that headline.
How does that
keep
work?
Going? Keep going.
So,
tell us more about this.
Yeah, so what they did is they printed.
Tell us more, Greg.
I will.
Okay.
They printed these sensors into temporary tattoo paper. And what they did within the sensors, not only so they could beam back the information, is they have a current that goes through the little wires, essentially, that are printed within the temporary tattoo. And what that does is that draws glucose.
Which is positively charged.
Yes, up near the skin's surface.
Nice.
So from there, they can read the glucose levels. And they've already tried this in non-diabetics and found out that it is very similar to the levels that you get from pricking a finger. So if they can make these last fairly long, which right now the length is about a day, that would cut down on the number of times you have to pierce the skin, which is, any diabetic would tell you, very annoying.
That would be a plus.
And slightly painful if you're not used to doing it, which I'm not a diabetic, but we did have to do that last year on each other. And that was not a fun little lab. Anyway, the good thing is also that these temporary tattoos apiece only cost a few cents. And that's what they think that they will be able to market them as eventually when they get them on the market, because there's not much to them, really.
I feel like even if you had to replace your temporary tattoo every day.
Mm-hmm. For a couple cents?
For
yeah.
a couple cents? That's huge. I
you could get cool dragon shapes and like do a sound effect.
That's
of
not
my,
bad.
Like my brain exploding from how cool this is.
Yeah, diabetes really needs some better PR these days.
Yeah.
That's a whole other market.
Yeah,
it's a tough illness.
Have, like the barbed wire that goes around your biceps all kinds of stuff.
Here's what it looks like right now. So it's just like a little pair of wings and then a little metal insert in it, and those are the
conductors. This is going
to
make kids.
Now I'm going to have to post
diabetes.
This on the show. Somebody remind me to put this on.
So
the
now
show.
What Casey's proposing is you can make this so much more than that. You can make it into a little heart that says mom on the inside of it. You can do sleeve tattoos.
Casey, you are brilliant because
I saw
mm-hmm. you're brilliant. I saw this story and it never even occurred to me that you could this is I don't know that this is analogous, but my wife is an audiologist, works with people with hearing aids and cochlear implants and all that kind of stuff. And one of the common complaints is, well, they're ugly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, so now they're starting to make devices that are actually kind of, you know, quote, cool.
Fashionable.
Which I think involves colors and glitter. But, you know,
my grandma might get one if it was covered in rhinestones.
Yeah,
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my wife is like, oh, I can't wait till I have to have a hearing aid. I'm going to deck it out.
This will be like people like buying glasses frames just so they can wear them and then like having them empty or like non-preserved.
Do you think people
glass?
People will have like empty hearing aids
Thank
with
you.
No electronics in it.
Like fake temporary tattoos.
But the fake
I love that idea.
That's totally a thing.
Oh, it's totally.
And that really
I knew an amazingly nice guy who was super careful about his diabetes and his blood sugar and all that. But he would occasionally sort of lose his mind when his blood sugar got too low to fuel his brain properly, and it would cause him to sort of act drunk and belligerent. And he's not listening, but if he was, he would be like totally on board with me saying this.
Is that called hangry?
Yeah, but in his case, it's like super hangry. Like,
oh man,
like this guy is he's not a small, he's not a big guy. He's about 5'6" or 5'7", and I once saw him pick up a guy taller than me, weighs more than me, in the middle of one of his
episodes,
and it was amazing.
Hypoglycemic Hulk mode.
Yeah, man, I've never seen anything like it. Anyway,
did he turn green?
Huh?
Did he turn green?
No, he's a he's
we
a
can
ginger.
Only hope.
He's a ginger. So you know, not to mention the strain on the kidneys and other organs that shortens lifespans, may lead to amputations, things like that. I mean, this would be super cool to be able to bring to the world. So keep going, University of California at San Diego.
Ooh. Yeah.
Good job. Yale School of Public Health researcher Brenda Cartmell and her team have discovered a gene variant that may make people more likely to develop an addiction to tanning.
Huh.
Yeah.
I have opinions.
Anybody
about
here
tanning.
Have? Well, you.
I don't like it.
Okay.
Full disclosure: I do have red hair and extremely pale and sensitive, delicate ginger skin.
that
burns when I stand too close to a window. So
I am swarthy and tend not to worry too much about exposure to UV, but I probably should. It probably doesn't matter that I'm swarthy. But the idea that UV light can be addictive, at least to a small number of people, is a kind of a a new idea. In mice, exposure to a daily dose of UV boosts beta endorphins, which activate the pleasure center of your brain, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of not surprising that that would be rewarding to the brain, which kind of gets off on endorphins. So the reason, according to one theory, is that the brain would want to seek out exposure to UV to sort of boost vitamin D synthesis. What do you think?
I was going to say, I wonder if there's an association between like seasonal affective disorder and being more likely to like have a tanning addiction. Oh. Like if you crave that UV because you have some sort of disorder that it
or vice that versa treats. That it causes it.
Maybe.
Who knows?
I don't know.
Investigators analyzed DNA samples from 79 people who showed signs of dependence on tanning, which I'm not sure. I guess if they were like...
You get the shakes.
Yeah, they were like... if they were like, you know, an interesting color, I guess. I don't know what would be a sign of dependence on tanning. 213 people were also looked at who tanned but weren't addicted. And they found that only one gene stood out among the 300,000 variations they examined. So nobody really knows what that gene does, but it seems to work mainly in the brain. And there's obvious implications here for dermatology, melanoma, the rate of which has tripled since 1975. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting. Do you remember that woman from a couple of years ago who gained notoriety as being...
Tanning mom. Oh, God.
What?
Yeah.
I don't
I've
know
never
about
heard
this.
Of this either.
Oh, yeah.
Tanning mom was...
It was Toddlers and Tiaras, wasn't it?
Oh, God.
I don't remember. No, I don't. I think they were sort of loosely connected, but if I remember, because I sort of remember a connection. But Tanning Mom was.
Yeah.
She just googled it.
She just saw her. Yeah.
Let me see.
She is.
You're sure?
The Tanning Mom was a color not found
mahogany
in.
In the
she was mahogany. She was mahogany.
Oh, that's not good.
Well, orange is the new black.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awful.
So,
med school.
I never saw that show. I'm sorry.
Tanning for me forever. All I see now is just extensive sun damage.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah, she's already sort of, unfortunately, she's addicted. That's terrible. But I also want to say that she looks like a saddle.
Oh, she looks like a raw leather hide. Yes.
Yeah. So careful with the sun, people. You don't want to look like an old suitcase. Mm. Yeah.
Man, that is.
Moving on swiftly.
I don't think I can come back from that.
That was shocking.
That initial reaction was very good, though.
Last week, a 17-year-old boy, whose name wasn't disclosed, was caught pretending to be a doctor at St. Mary's Medical Center in Florida. Yes. He was caught after 1 month by a patient. Strikes me as odd.
He finally called him out?
Yeah, well,
did he not get pimped
or
this entire
knew him?
Time?
I don't know.
He wore a white coat. So I guess that's all you need.
I mean, really.
You guys are spending a lot on medical education. A lot. Yes, he's doing very well. Yeah, remember this, M2, the Nightingale. If this guy can do it, you'll be fine. He wore a white coat with the St. Mary's Medical Center logo embroidered along with the word anesthesiology. Stethoscope, ooh. Face mask. He had it all. He was caught finally in an exam room with a real doctor who was doing a patient exam at the time. OB-GYN. That doc had gotten a note from the boy asking if he could shadow him on rounds, but he'd not seen the kid prior to the day of the patient exam. The boy's mom told cops that he was under the care of a doctor, and the hospital and police decided not to pursue charges, although the kid was detained as he fled the hospital. So, yeah, apparently a security guard said that he was known around the hospital as a doctor and that he could be seen on several floors, entering patients' rooms, conversing with hospital employees, and nobody ever questioned that whether he was actually a physician or not.
And how old was this person?
17.
He must have really gotten around for everyone like know him in the first month.
He must be really super curious.
Must be.
He's like catch me if you can sort of stuff. Yeah.
What's weird is that the people who finally reported was like, there's a small child dressed up, you know, like
that everyone seems to like and respect. Yes. And listens to. I don't understand.
Hospital claims he never had any patient contact, so that's.
Oh, okay.
But
they said they saw him go into patients' rooms.
That's at odds with what the witnesses do say. Video surveillance.
He just went in to hang out.
Video surveillance apparently showed him walking around, talking with people, wandering in the ER lobby wearing his white coat, but not entering patient rooms.
See, I'm in medical school, and even I couldn't pull that off. Like, I know how doctors act. I couldn't pull
that off. Yeah, that'd be bold.
I'm surprised that nurses weren't like, who are you? Because those people don't, you know.
Nurses know what's up.
They do not mess around.
Yeah, yep. But the thing is, like, have you looked at some of the people in our class? Like, there's some very young-looking people.
Yeah.
Like, 23-year-olds who could pass for 17 easily. Truly.
Like me.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
I meant exactly.
I suppose.
No, but it's true. Like, there's some baby faces at our school and in Iowa in general.
I'm not even that much of a baby face. And I got asked last year, I was working at a middle school, and I got asked if I should have the student price or the teacher price when I went through the cafeteria.
I'm going to take that as a compliment, not as an
insult.
That's
what she said.
And I'm
she
just
was
going
like,
to walk away now.
Yeah, she was. I was like, teacher. She was like, well, someday you'll be happy that you
Wait,
look really
is,
young. And
which
I was
one
like,
is cheaper?
Oh.
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Is the student price cheaper?
I think so.
Yes, no, I'm totally
student.
Oh,
man.
Student.
I know. You missed it.
Well, that ship sailed.
Good opportunity. Seriously.
Oh, my 50 cents. I want it back.
Does anybody else have anything else to talk about? Because I'm sort of out.
I did find a cool story about stigma surrounding psychiatrists whose patients commit suicide.
In The Atlantic?
Yeah.
I read the same article.
This is really intriguing.
We planned this.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. We're soulmates.
Mm-hmm. Basically.
So, yeah, they're talking about how mental health practitioners whose clients kill themselves face stigma from other colleagues. They face huge tolls on their psyches and also are sort of ostracized by their colleagues. And it makes them more reluctant to take on suicidal patients in the future because of this outcome.
Hmm.
Which is great because, you know, suicidal people have all the help they can, you know, they can get.
Yeah. So that's, sorry, bull crap. because,
yeah, that sucks, I know.
You can't save everybody. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, you try to help those people. And of course, like,
this is a very recalcitrant. I mean, this is a very difficult problem. I mean, suicide, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not like,
this is kind of a problem with any sort of thing that's based so heavily on outcome. Like, it makes people less likely to take cases that are very severe. I mean, it happens everywhere in medicine. Like, surgeons don't want people who are at higher risk of dying because it's going to ruin their record. It's going to, you know, it's going to stay with them. So then those people just don't get help or have to take a not as good surgeon or something, just whoever they can get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't always choose your patients based on how good it's going to make you look. I mean, good grief.
But people try to sometimes.
Yes, they do.
Psychiatrists have the option of saying, like, well, we're not taking any new patients right now. And they'll have.
Don't all doctors have that option? I mean, I suppose ER docs
sort
might
of.
Not be like, sorry.
Yeah, but like private practice do, right. I'm pretty sure. But
yeah.
Hmm. Hey, how popular are you?
Who, me?
I don't know.
Yes.
How?
I wonder that sometimes.
How many Facebook friends do you have?
Yes.
I like to think,
know.
Who cares? Does it matter?
Well,
what's the question about?
The Lancet published a study recently where they suggest that prioritizing medical students with lots of friends for flu shots could help increase the number of healthcare workers protected against the virus.
I love it.
Yeah, so basically, you know, if you're real popular, I mean, this is, you know, this is obvious, you know, if you have a lot of social connections, you should you'll be more likely to spread the flu to other people. Duh. I just think it's interesting, like, medical students should be the, you know,
if no one likes me, does that mean I don't have to get shots?
Yeah, well,
and I'm less susceptible to disease.
Yes,
perfect.
Make yourself unlikable, and you'll be free from.
Thank
bacteria
God.
Bacteria will hate me.
I get the feeling from the study that only. So they kind of struggled to get people, to get healthcare workers vaccinated in the UK. And I don't know, they didn't address why, but
really,
it's at present only half of healthcare workers are vaccinated. The government wants 75% of healthcare workers to be vaccinated.
That is so low.
I thought 75 was low. I mean, you know.
Yeah, no, that's their goal. That is upsetting.
So, they've clearly got some work to do in the UK. But more than 200 medical students there gave researchers information about their social networks and how much time they spent with other students and all that kind of stuff. And they were able to do some sort of magic math on this and figure out that, you know, their networks were important for, okay. So
I guess what you're saying is that it's a good thing I have no friends and don't get out much.
Yes, it is a good thing. I was going to say.
You are so good for public health.
I have another side to this story.
Okay.
I just came across an article in The Atlantic talking about how a study out of Concordia University in Montreal. Yeah.
Represent.
And then Rush in Chicago. They found that friendship is good for your heart.
Well, that's
nonsense.
So, do you want to die from, you know, measles loneliness or heart attack?
Heart attack is commonly caused by loneliness. Little known fact. That's why your heart hurts.
What do you mean?
When you're alone.
Is that really true?
No. Oh my God, no.
Okay.
No, but I'm saying that's what this study says.
That
was so believable, Casey. I started to get worried.
Said it with such a
little known fact.
Yeah.
Little known fact.
If we want to go back to the beginning of life for this study, this came out a while back that said that in a study of pregnant women who were instructed to take fish while they were pregnant, to eat fish, they found that actually...
take them from the grocery store, take them out of the river.
Stealing is bad, okay? I was going to say to take fish oil, but I don't know that it was exactly fish oil that they took, so I decided to say to eat fish, but I ended up combining the two. Anyway,
well done.
They were told to essentially ingest polyunsaturated fatty acids, or omega-3s, while they were pregnant. And the study actually found out that the benefits of taking this actually outweighed the possible risk of mercury exposure, which is something that doctors have battled back and forth with for a long time, deciding, all right, what is safe in pregnancy and what is not? Mm-hmm. So after 20 months, the babies of women in the highest third for blood levels of polyunsaturated fats, and thus the greatest mercury level exposures, showed improved performance in the psychomotor developmental index, which is a test of motor skills and things in children.
Hmm. Very cool.
So take from that what you will.
Do you know, did they control for like where the fish were raised, if they were farm raised or wild? Because I've read that farm raised fish have more mercury than wild fish.
Well, that would kind of make sense. They're sort of I would think they would be in greater proximity to
industrial contaminants,
I guess you could say. So that would.
So this study was done in the Seychelles. So I would imagine that it was just caught in the ocean.
Mm.
So nearby to them.
That sounds delicious.
I love fish.
I love delicious science.
I'll be part of this study.
You know,
I'd have to be pregnant. No.
Yeah,
no. Maybe I take it all back.
Whoa, hold on.
This reminds me of after the Fukushima disaster in Japan, with the tidal wave that destroyed the nuclear power plant, mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden on Facebook there appeared these maps with a horribly colored diagram of what purported to be the spread of radiation across the sea, and it turned out that's not what it was, but that was how it was presented. And I was freaking out about fish and tuna, because I like tuna, freaking out about fish and how we shouldn't, have fish anymore. My wife, the scientist, went and actually looked at studies and told me that science was calling me out as a fool.
I should also make a slight amendment here. One of the important distinctions in the omega fatty acids, there's omega-6 and omega-3, which you might have heard about. In this case, the biggest benefit was seen with omega-6 versus omega-3. So some omega-3 is fine, but it's the ratio that is more important.
Mm-hmm. Also, fatty acids, I think it's omega-3, but it may be 3 and 6, are thought to maybe be good to combat depression. So if that's something that you're worried about when you're pregnant or after you're pregnant, might as well be taking omega-3 anyway.
Excellent.
We have our recommendations.
Check that box.
That's right. We're in good, good shape.
It's a check mark sound.
All right. Well, we have reached the end of another wonderful, magical show here on the Short Code Podcast.
So long. Farewell.
The files are in the box. In the case.
If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. This is super important because it helps spread the word. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed, pleased about something, if you enjoyed the way Caroline basically reacted to every story today as though it was like awesome, which I appreciated, leave us a message at theshortcode.com. There's a few ways to do that. Do follow us and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by the strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine student government and the Writing and Humanities program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing music is by C2C. I'll talk to you in a week.